You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On March 20th, 2014, Susan Weisner presented the second lecture in a new five-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. In Western cultures, social dance has been an important component in defining society and class structure since the Renaissance. According to Weisner, strict rules applied to both male and female dancers of the time, although following the commencement of the Civil War, soldiers were permitted to bring their swords into the ballroom. For some soldiers, dance was a form of therapy. In this podcast, Weisner talks about the popular dances of the time, including the well-known Virginia Reel, and their place in the context of the Civil War. Susan Weisner obtained her undergraduate degree at Goucher College in Kentucky and her master's and PhD in England. She is a former dance and drama instructor at the University of Virginia. She now has a studio at the McGuffrey Art Center and does research on the intersection of language and movement. The series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses, Dances with Soldiers. Here's Susan Weisner.
I saw my husband look back at me laughing with the story about the veterans, because when I was about 13, I went to Gettysburg and went onto the battlefield, and the two little old ladies in front of me waiting to go in. Of course, I'm 13, my sister's 11, and they go, "Do you remember when the Civil War veterans came to see us at school, Charlemagne?" And it's still... And of course, we howled over that. We thought that was the funniest thing. But that would have been the late 60s, and they would have been about, you know, my age now. So they probably did see real veterans. So I'm going to talk for a while about dance, and I'm only talking about social dance. I'm not talking about the theater at all, even though that could be a book. Okay. In Western cultures, dance has been an important component in defining society and class structure since the Renaissance. European ballrooms were microcosms of society with status manifestly displayed. The importance of this public display in the ballroom continued when the gentry immigrated to America, no matter the reason for leaving Europe. In all sections of the colonies, those in the upper classes carried on the traditions of dance in their new home. In the 19th century, however, dance played such an integral role in the Southern elite culture that it deserves special attention. As historian W.T. Couch has stated, dancing has perhaps had more place in the South than in any other part of the country. What then happened as the Civil War destroyed the political and economic base of Southern society? As it had been in the Renaissance and Baroque periods in Europe, dance encompassed several Southern aristocratic virtues. It required refinement, deportment, visible expertise, aesthetic value, and the financial resources to educate oneself in the art. This is not to imply that these qualities were not admired in all parts of the U.S., only to say that in the South, these qualities constituted the basis for a Southern identity. Outward appearances counted a great deal in the South. The way one dressed, acted, danced, determined the way in which one was viewed by others and reflected the Southern ideals of social order. From an early age, the elite groomed their children to assume the roles of master and mistress at adulthood. Before the war, several educational academies offered their services as places of guidance in one's class responsibilities. Although some Southerners sent their children north to be schooled, many kept their children in the South where the idea of Southern gentility could be ingrained. In 1830, a Northerner commented upon the display of fashion, taste, and refinement at the University of Georgia commencement. Dances held at the academies for graduation or other celebration blatantly displayed the status of the students. Mary Chestnut, a member of the South Carolina Boykin family, remembered balls at which the planter elite danced upon a stage and the others below. If dancing above the rest of society did not instill the proper superior attitude, other forms of education, such as advice books and magazines, produced scores of informative articles concerning fashion, entertainment, dance, and socially acceptable behavior. In addition, one could hire a dance master to train the children in dance and deportment. While many of the masters in the South during the late 18th and early 19th century were refugees from the French Revolution, by the mid-19th century, most were American by birth, although many took on French names. Let's see, what do we have? Okay, we're good. Most towns, no matter how small, could boast at least one dance master. And in larger cities such as Savannah, Georgia, several dance masters operated out of studios or hotels. The Savannah Daily Morning News of January 1st, 1861, lists notices for three dance masters. If one lived on an outlying plantation, you could bring an itinerant master to your home to teach dance. Few records remain of the itinerants, but a vast amount of newspaper advertisements and articles attest to the existence of more stable masters. One such was a Mr. Nichols. It was written about him, and I quote, "It will be seen by reference to our advertising column that Mr. Nichols will commence his third session at the St. Andrew's Hall this afternoon. He is an old resident and too well known as a gentleman and teacher of his art to require a comminium at our hands. We dropped in last Saturday afternoon at his closing exhibition and found a large and thrilled audience. The dancing of his little scholars was alike creditable to them and to him." In Atlanta, a relatively new town, in 1861, Professor Knott established a dance academy at the corner of Peachtree and Marietta Streets. There are a lot of Peachtree Streets in Atlanta. He charged $10 for a 12-week course and offered classes on Monday and Tuesday afternoons for ladies, mistresses, and masters, and the same evenings for young gentlemen. The funny thing I find here is that his ad is next to an ad for caskets. It's fun. The first 3 years of the Civil War did not impede Mr. Knott's business. However, after 1863, there are no indications of his presence in Atlanta. Another master, however, Mr. Lewis of Savannah, advertised classes in 1861, but his school appears to have closed during the war. Mr. Lewis resumed advertising for students in 1866, and several recitals were announced in that year. Did the war interrupt the career of Mr. Lewis, the Savannah master? Between the years 1862 and 1865, Lewis, who taught out of Armory Hall originally, virtually disappeared. But I did a search of the Georgia Rolls of Confederate Soldiers that lists 10 men with the name L. Lewis, L-O-U-I-S, or L. Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. Disregarding the latter spelling, although he used both, and removing those who were killed from the list, only one man was left, L. Lewis, chief musician. His occupation in the Army fits very well with the skills of a dance master, and it's possible that this is our Savannah man. Entrusted with the responsibility of creating refined, well-rounded pupils, most masters taught music and fencing as well as dance and deportment. Dance masters then should have been respected, but on the contrary, only a few earned such praise as Mr. Nichols of Savannah. Most only held the status equal to that of a governess, important when necessary, discarded after the lesson was learned. Eliza Andrews lumped dance masters together with chicken farmers and minstrels, and in fact joked about the future of men and women after the war by saying she would be a washerwoman and Captain Palfrey would be a dance master. Nonetheless, dance masters were necessary for the social education of the youth. One gentleman soldier, when his sister questioned him about his opinion of dance classes, strongly suggested she not only attend a dance school, but also practice continually. With the proper instruction, his sister could shine in the ballroom and receive praise for her public demeanor. To the Southerner, a ball was a heightened level of reality. The ballroom created a scene in which the characters could act out their oft-rehearsed, established roles. Women were expected to be someone to be admired, adored, and protected, to make their own yeast, lard, soap, and make with equal skill a rough dress for a slave or a ball gown for themselves. One story offers an excellent example of an elite woman's dual role as belle and mistress. Mary Boykin Chestnut relates the story of a Mrs. Preston of Columbia, South Carolina. "I remember a scene which took place at a ball given by Mrs. Preston while Mr. Preston was in Louisiana. Mrs. Preston was resplendent in diamonds, point lace, velvet train, etc. There is a gentle dignity about her which is very attractive, and her voice is low and sweet, and her will is iron. She is an exceedingly well-informed person, but quiet, retiring, and reserved. Well, at that ball, Governor Manning came to me and said, a little while ago, William, a slave, came to tell her that his brother John was drunk in the cellar and mad with drink, and that he had a carving knife, which he was brandishing his drunken fury and keeping everybody from their business, threatening to kill anyone who dared to go in the basement. Mrs. Preston followed William down to the basement, holding up her skirts. John was bellowing like a bull of Bashan. Mrs. Preston walked up to him. Give me that knife. He handed it to her. She laid it on a table. And now come with me, she said, putting her hand on his collar. She led him to the empty smokehouse, locked him in, put the key in her pocket, and returned to the ball without a ripple on her plastic face to show what she had done. The hard realities of managing a household in the 19th century often interfered with a woman's social life, yet she managed to mix both in an attempt to succeed in her dual role. Just as Mrs. Preston's behavior in the ballroom earned her the admiration and respect of others, if she had shown any agitation over the situation, her reputation would have been tarnished. A blunder of propriety could also ruin one's reputation as well as one's chances for finding the proper mate. For example, if a lady refused to dance, she must have good reason and do so gently. Never could she refuse one gentleman, then accept another partner, nor should she dance with one man and flirt with another over the first shoulder. Such a public display of rejection and or attraction would not do in a society that prided itself on tact and diplomacy, and these are coming straight out of the dance manuals of the period. If a lady seemed too eager, she could be branded a vixen. Gestures considered too forward included standing too close to the dance floor, leading the man to the floor, clinging to his arm, and limiting her selection of partners. Men noticed the women engaged female virtues by the ladies' behavior and appearance. But men, too, could be judged in the ballroom. Gallant knights did not spit, extinguish cigars on floors or walls, or request a lady's hand without formal introduction. Although the rules eased somewhat during the war, men could then wear swords into the ballroom. A man who disregarded principles of deportment could run the risk of bearing the appellation rogue. Every gesture held significance and hid a double meaning. By utilizing gestural language, young men and women could avoid the often restraining attention of their chaperones. Thus, the courtship ritual of the elite Southerner often occurred in the ballroom. The language of the fan, and this is actually fanology, so that it has its instructions on there, was practiced fluently in the ballroom. It's an excellent example of surreptitious gestural speech. With a flick of the wrist, lovers could agree upon the times for secret meetings. You just kind of put it up. If you wanted to meet at 3, you would only show 3 stems of the fan. Or communicate their secret desires. By the same token, prescribed gestures and dance were also crucial elements. The choice of arm position for certain steps could send subtle messages. For example, joining hands in a straightforward fashion with your arms in front of your body sends a different message from placing your arms above and below your face. Now, it's a little window through you can peer. Eye contact during the bows and dance also indicated a dancer's interest in his or her partner. Dances of the 19th century were very erotic, although the sensuality was hidden under a film of propriety. It was no wonder that the waltz was so well liked. Partners not only stood arm in arm, they moved closer to one another before sliding coyly away. It was not the waltz we know today. The dizziness associated with the whirling of the waltz in a circle also produced a euphoric high. Popular literature noticed the connection between dance and love and exploited it. In the poem, A Stolen Kiss, verse 12 reads, "When next we met, 'twas at a ball, her looks we quite unmannered. And 'twas with trembling heart I asked for the next set, her hand." Eventually, the lover in the poem, finally bold enough, steals a kiss from sweet Lou. The implications of behavior, both in and out of the ballroom, did not change when the war began. Instead, Southern dancers attached new significance to their actions. For women, the war added to the burden. Life became difficult. However, women were still expected to continue the traditional ideals. Most Southern ladies attempted to keep up appearances, even though, as Scott notes, they were harder to sustain near the end of the war. The image of the... it's Carol Burnett. The image of the fictional belle, Scarlett O'Hara, in Gone with the Wind, dressed in her velvet drapes, is not far from wrong. Women turned the skirts of ball gowns so the frayed hems would not show, or covered rents in the fabric with lace, which, as one girl noted, could make almost anything look respectable. When fine fabrics could not be bought, women resorted to homespun and calico. Journalists admonished wealthy women to set the example of sacrifices. Yet, blockades aside, the women did receive news of current fashions. The Savannah Daily Morning News, on 28th of April, 1863, noted that hoops were finally assuming rational dimensions, and the ballroom dress is almost denuded of ornament in London. A man's actions in the heat of battle could also affect his success in the ballroom. Sinful in the eyes of the ladies were the men who stayed safely at desk jobs or the shoulder straps who could be found lounging about public resorts in Charleston. I'm going to read you a nice little thing. During the session of the legislature, there were weekly dances and young ladies of Milledgeville, Georgia, who had friends in the country nearby. I boarded with Mr. Martin Edwards, and his daughter Annie invited Miss Sue Woodall, who lived in Jones County near Haddock Station, to come into the dance. She was at that time a buxom, rosy-cheeked lass, and she asked me if I was going to the dance that night. I replied no, that I had no change of clothing whatever and nothing suitable to wear. She at once said, "I have 7 yards of pretty woven jeans you ever saw. I carded every ounce of the wool myself, dyed the wool, and wove the cloth smoothly on our loom, and I will gladly give it to you if you will accept it." Of course, I thanked her gratefully, and she said she would bring it the next time we have a dance. Then she asked me, "How is it that you have no clothes except those you have on?" I said, "My valise, with all my clothes in it, was lost after the Battle of Missionary Ridge." She looked at me with a frown on her forehead, curled her lips, and said, "Were you in that run?" I said, "We called it a retreat." She got up, put her arms akimbo, and said, "Well, I call it a run, and I want to say just here and now, no man who runs from Missionary Ridge can wear Sue Woodall's jeans." She was right. I never did. Staunch Confederate women displayed their scorn for inadequate soldiers by ignoring them and choosing to dance only with the brave. That poor boy never even made it to the dance. When entering notes of the day in their journals, diaries, and letters, Southern writers often included information on the balls they attended. A valuable addition to this information was the inclusion of dance styles. The English country dance, codified by John Playford in 1651, was very popular throughout England and America in the 17th and 18th centuries. And in the early 19th century, the country dance retained its popularity in both North and South, especially in frontier areas. In 1827, an editor of the Georgia Statesman remembered the days when one could enjoy both cotillion and the country dance in Georgia's frontier capital. The country dance was not, as its name implies, a style enjoyed only in the country by less civilized people. On the contrary, this style delighted wealthy dancers as well as poor. Couples could dance simultaneously in long lines for as many as will. The figures were not simple, and in many instances required the skill gained through dance instruction. Yet by the advent of the Civil War, the Virginia reel, usually danced at the end of the evening, was one of the few remaining country dances. They had been superseded in the South by the French quadrille or cotillion. In 1855, a hotel in Milledgeville hosted weekly cotillion parties while the legislature was in session. During the war, the soldiers included it in their letters home. As one said, "I promised to tell you something about the young ladies of Caroline. I went to a party last week and played and danced all night long, danced one cotillion after sunup the next morning. I never enjoyed myself better in my life." And another said, "While I'm writing, there are some boys in the other tent next to mine playing cards. Every now and then I hear them holler out. Others are down at the captain's having a cotillion, some dancing, fiddling, and cracking bones." So the cotillion is it's the same thing as the quadrille. It's the four people, and it's where we eventually get the square dance. The French quadrille, which consisted of the figures Le Pantalon, Le Tel, Le Poule, and Le Pastoral, had been popular as early as 1802 and remained in the repertoire of the dancers along with the newer Lancers, Prince Imperial, and Caledonian. The titles of each of these quadrilles implies a generic dance with definitive figures, just the same as the Virginia reel. Yet several variations appear in dance manuals and sheet music instructions. For example, the Lancers generally contains figures such as Les Trois and La Grâce, but each of these may have a different pattern. The patterns the dancers knew depended upon their dance master or the group with whom they danced. One English journalist visiting the South during the war noted a regional difference. He said, "They danced the finale of the quadrille here with all sorts of figures, one of them like the last figure in the Lancers, walking around and giving the right and left hand alternately." So everybody know that's a grand chain if you do square dancing. Other particularly Southern renditions of quadrilles developed during the war, yet the only true difference were the titles and perhaps the musical melody. The Dixie Quadrille, which touted the inclusion of the popular Dixie melody in the music, contained typical steps in various arrangements. Although frequently mentioned in diaries and letters, not everyone enjoyed dancing the quadrille. Some considered it old-fashioned. A young Georgia girl, Eliza Andrews, complained in her journal that the Prince Imperial is too slow and stately. Even the Lancers are tame. The racing galop, or some people say gallop, captured the fancy of the Confederate youth as it had the Europeans and Northerners in the 1830s. So too did the dotante, a waltz-type dance done to either duple or triple meter. Yet while those in Europe and the North might be able to express their preferences openly, the Southern idea of elite dance styles still tempered the dancers' psyches, because such racy dances were inappropriate for those with aristocratic bearing. One could only admit to indulging slightly in the galop and dotante, as did one of Hood's soldiers in a letter home. The turbulent nature of these dances reflected the changing world of the early Victorian period, and for the Southerner, the violence that surrounded the Southern population during the war. The figures of the galop include a game reminiscent of chicken, in which one couple races towards another, waiting only until the last moment to break apart to avoid a collision. Drawings of ballroom dancers flying through the galop depict the overwhelming speed with which they dance and often show several people falling over domino style. Another quick-paced dance, the polka, receives little mention in Southern diaries and letters. Originally danced on the London stage in 1844, the polka quickly became a rage. American dance master Alan Dodworth composed and published the very popular Cali Polka in 1845. Described by another dance master as very simple, consisting merely of three steps and a rest, the polka shocked most people in the South by its vivacity. Nevertheless, according to manuals and historical observation, the polka was danced frequently in the ballrooms of America, often to the exclusion of the quadrille. In light of the extreme popularity of the polka in America, one must question its place in the South. Did the white Southerners dance the polka and not mention it? Or did they consider the dance inappropriate for their self-conscious society? Research of Southern sources through 1866 finds few references to the polka other than that which denigrates the dance, and I quote, "A gentleman describing the absurdity of a man dancing the polka said that it appeared as if the individual had a hole in his pocket and was futilely endeavoring to shake a shilling out of the leg of his trousers." By this absurd portrait, it appears that the writer considered the polka foolishly simple. All one needed to do to dance it correctly would be to imagine that loose coin. The idea would have been anathema to a society in which personal accomplishment and decorum rated as virtues. Now you have to know that at times the use of the term polka mazurka appears in the literature and in musical titles, but that dance is a triple meter dance, which is not the polka, and the first beat is accented. A true mazurka has the accents on beats 2 and 3. Just a little dance talk. In contrast, the quadrille was a much more noble dance with relatively sedate steps and intricate figures. A descendant of the contredanse danced by the French aristocracy, the quadrille was brought to the South in the late 18th century. The regal aura of the complex quadrille attracted those who believed in the myth of the elite. While the steps could be walked instead of using technically correct dance movements, the five figures of each quadrille contained several specific patterns within them. And an evening of cotillions would prevent the untutored dancer from participating fully. Further, if the quadrille enhanced the double image of accomplishment and wealth, the easily picked up silly wiggling of the polka could tarnish the illusion of breeding. Just as the polka created ludicrous visions, any strange dancing would be a source of amusement. Josephine Clay Habersham commented on the new style dancing of two high men, 6 feet, 2 inches, in her diary entry dated September 30th, 1863. Some very funny dancing, quite amusing. Whatever this new style of dance, Its silly movement obviously did not qualify as society dancing, which showed politeness and polished manners at their best. While politeness did not exist only in the South, the ideals with which it was connected did reflect the Southern attempt to maintain a separate identity through culture. So too did the popular dances of Southern belles and gents. As an omelet without eggs or magistrate without authority would alike be ridiculous, so dancing without music would be an absurdity. As dance master Edward Ferrero wrote so eloquently in one of his dance manuals, the dancers of the mid-19th century needed music to accompany the rhythm of their feet. Just as important as the knowledge of the prescribed dance steps was a selection of music, a basic understanding of musical rhythm, and acquisition of proper accompaniment. The dance manuals of the period were explicit in their instruction. One contains the information that quadrille music should consist of 8 bars of music for a single strain and 16 bars for a double strain or figure. It then follows with the number of bars necessary for particular steps, as well as the admonition to the musicians to play with life and animation, also with strong accentuations and in regular time. The types of instruments varied depending on the location of the ball, the size of the room, and the number of musicians. The violin stood out as the instrument of choice, with a pianoforte acceptable as a solo instrument. Successive additions of horns and stringed instruments eventually formed bands of 10 or more pieces. If no traditional instruments could be found, vocal song could suffice. Borrowing from the slaves' collection of instruments, white dancers also did use bones to supply their rhythmic base. Undaunted by the war, musicians were found both at home and in camp, although in at least one instance, a dance was canceled due to the band returning to their regiment. In Savannah, groups such as the Savannah City Orchestra and the Palmetto Band played in homes and public halls. Women played the piano to accompany dancing at family gatherings and to assist in the dance education of the young. Josephine Habersham frequently noted playing for her daughters while they practiced their dancing skills. The women were more than capable accompanists, since a girls' school that did not offer piano, violin, or guitar lessons was a rare exception in the antebellum South. When war disrupted the lives of the elite, the music incorporated its sounds. In Richmond, the jingling of spurs and clanking of sabers blended with the fiddle and banjo to produce the sound by which Virginia Bells and officers of the Army of Northern Virginia danced on the eve of the Battle of Brandy Station in June 1863. Another source of accompanists came in from the slave population. A tradition of black fiddlers and banjo players predominated in the South. Mrs. Detweiler, an Atlanta resident, remembered that old Sambo with his fiddle and Cicero with his banjo would furnish the music. The black musicians influenced the white dancers beyond setting the tempo of the dance. Although ladies requested the dances and musicians usually complied, the black fiddler often called the dance and all looked to him to begin the festivities. Murta Avery recounts a ball at which the white dancers were at the mercy of George Walker, the Negro fiddler, and she wrote, "He was the most famous man of his craft in the Piedmont region. There he was that night in all his glory at the head of his band of banjoists, violinists, and violoncellists. He was grandeur and gloss personified when he made preliminary bow and flourish, held his bow aloft, and set the ball in motion. Honor your partners, and didn't we do as George told us to do?" Such dancing provoked melodies followed almost as bewitched one's feet. Accomplished slave musicians not only played for their fellow blacks, masters, and neighbors, they also accompanied Confederate soldiers as they went to war. Phil, slave of the prominent Howell Cobb family in Georgia, traveled to Camp Georgia in Norfolk, Virginia, at the request of the young master, Johnny Cobb. A letter from Johnny to his uncle, Colonel John B. Lamar in Macon, Georgia, notes, "A great many young ladies from Norfolk come out here the evenings. We have a dance nearly every evening, and Phil plays the fiddle for them." If the regiment had a band, dancers were never without music. One soldier mentioned that he was to attend a military ball at which there would be 2 brass bands and a string band to make music. Some talented bands joined the Army in toto. The Mountain Saxhorn Band, formed in 1855 in Stanton, Virginia, enlisted with the 5th Virginia Regiment and became the official regimental band. The Palmetto Band of Savannah also enlisted as a group and played for military functions as well as civilian soirees. Both professional and amateur musicians formed bands. Small groups played informally, and some became quite popular. In the evenings, they gave concerts at the camps or played for the soldier to waltz their ladies round. Good bands were taken to homes surrounding the camps to play for parties given by the ladies of the surrounding countryside. However, a bandsman's life was not strictly music. Along with musical responsibilities such as taps, reveille, drummings out, and funeral marches, band members worked as hospital aides, surgeons, and foot soldiers. Joining the Confederate Army early in the war, many bandsmen were killed during the fighting or lost their lives to the diseases that ravaged the troops. If they managed to avoid bullets and measles, the musicians were still vulnerable to scathing criticism by the dancers. Although most bands pleased their audiences, some were even given balls in their honor, others earned negative evaluations. One gentleman noticed that at one ball, the dance consisted of cotillions without order or cadence to the sound of an atrocious violin squeakily played. One lady likened the scraping of the fiddles at one dance to the minor key that wailed the ruin of Confederate hopes near the end of the war. In spite of the off-key grating sounds, dancers tolerated the less talented musicians as long as they played Southern songs, such as Dixie, the Bonnie Blue Flag, Maryland, My Maryland. It should also be noted that in Maryland, where many music publishers operated, Southern music caused great trouble for publishers and composers. The sale of music such as Charles Kerr and Henry McCaffrey's Stonewall, Quickstep, was prohibited. The singing and playing of Maryland, My Maryland, and other distinctly Southern songs was banned. And although some were jailed for it, music was composed, published, played, and danced to in Maryland as elsewhere in the South. In 1861, Schlesinger, a Southern composer, wrote several dance tunes which he dedicated to the young ladies of the sunny South. Not content to simply dedicate his songs on one frontispiece, he captured the idea of a unique Southern culture through dance music. It reads, "The South must not only fight her own battles, but sing her own songs and dance to music composed by her own children." Why did Southerners dance? Early in the 19th century, a geographer of Louisiana proposed that the warmer climate of the South influenced the popular amusements of the people, and that the principal amusement of both sexes was dance. One Southern belle disagreed. She didn't dance because of the heat. She noted in her diary that she nearly danced her feet off in spite of the hot weather. Okay. Southerners danced to celebrate weddings, holidays, and graduations. They met in the ballrooms to flirt, and court one another, and to talk. Dances gave one an excuse to see friends who lived too far away for daily conversation, a chance to show off new clothes, and to see and be seen. Dances gave hotels an opportunity for profit, and dance masters displayed their expertise through public balls. In most cases, the war did not deter Southern dancer. Each of the above reasons for dance remained throughout the Civil War, with the addition of a few war-related excuses to have a hop. Holidays, such as New Year's and May Day, provided an excuse for impromptu dance or a well-publicized ball. Costume balls continued to be held, also called fancy balls, especially in connection with festivities such as the Mardi Gras and at resorts where fun and relaxation were common. In 1862, Lucy Cobb devoted several pages of one letter to her then-fiancé, Johnny Cobb, to a description of an impromptu fancy ball held at Madison Springs Resort in Georgia. The dancers arrived in costumes depicting characters such as Anne Boleyn, King of the Cannibal Isles, Mrs. Busybody, and Flora McFloozy, whose despairing cry is, "Nothing to wear!" Patriotism also prompted dancers to convene. In Savannah, Georgia, a grand Confederate ball was held on the 4th of July, even though, or perhaps because, the Confederate States of America did not recognize the 4th as a national holiday. One holiday celebrated by both Yankees and Confederates was February 22nd. In 1864, the new Forage House Ballroom in South Carolina was the site of a Washington's birthday ball. The fact that these dates still constituted cause for celebration connotes a contradiction in the Southern mind. Although separated from Union by war, Southerners continue to revere their heritage as Americans. Special groups such as the Young Men's Association, the Mechanics Guilds, and firemen held annual balls for the pleasure of the members, as well as for profit. Military groups were not excluded. In May of 1863, the field officers of the 2nd and 5th Brigades, Price's Division, hosted a ball at the Anthony House Hotel in Little Rock, Arkansas. Sometimes the young used dance simply as an excuse for gaiety and excitement. Louisa Minor of Pantops noted in her journal entry for Christmas 1863 that Wednesday the children had a dance and I joined them. The beaux were plenty, but a scarcity of girls. I had my fun. I find when I get a chance, I get into a merry party and the old taste returns, and I enjoy a dance as much as ever. Mary Wigfall of Texas wrote of her time living with General Johnston's family in Vineville, Georgia, and said, "Many homes in this fair Georgian town opened their doors and called the young people aside to make merry, and many a pleasant evening we spent with music and song and dancing, the young officers passing to and fro on sick leave during periods of cessation and hostilities, or having 2 or 3 days furlough would find delight in the glimpses of a brighter side of life. One didn't have to dance themselves. Watching could be just as fun." As John Wallace wrote to his parents from Stanton in May of 1862, "There are also about 60 or 70 deserters placed in the upper story of the courthouse as prisoners. They're a very jovial set and make a great deal of fun for us. They play the fiddle, dance, and sing songs." Not dancing could be frustrating, however. One Georgia belle complained heartily that she could hardly wait for the social season. Other youngsters were more fortunate. Josephine Habersham, the mistress of Avon, which was a Georgia plantation, invited several men over for tea, and when no beau arrived, she played for her daughters to dance anyway. Habersham, who had several sons fighting for the Confederacy, later escorted her daughters to a dancing party. One girl, age 9, didn't join any sets, but her 10 and 14-year-old sister danced just about every time. For those who didn't dance, and even for those who did, delightful conversation played a major role. Mrs. Habersham admitted accompanying the girls to the party for her own enjoyment. The affair afforded her the chance to visit with neighbors and share information about the men at war. Those private conversations masked or attempted to hide messages of love and desire. As Mary Chestnut so eloquently stated, flirtation is the business of society. Flirtation was also the business of the ballroom. As I stated earlier, dances were metaphors for courtship, with eyes peering through windows formed by the arms and quadrilles and bodies swaying voluptuously. Around the room and the waltz, a palpable aura of sensuality surrounded the dance in the 19th century. The Civil War did little to dull the senses of the young and virile. Whether on furlough or at the front, whether married or single, the men found ladies and vice versa. With courtship a primary reason to dance, realization of its functions was evident when partners later married. As one soldier related, "I fell in love with my wife at a dance while on Christmas leave in 1864. During the war, the men at camp danced just as they had before the war, but the war gave a new aspect to it. Now, instead of dancing only for amusement and to support social values, they also indicated their advocacy of the Confederate military effort through military balls held in the camp to celebrate victories. Halsey Wigfall wrote his sister in 1864 that the evening after a battle, they had a dance at headquarters to which was gathered the beauty and the chivalry. In another instance, the officers at Camp Carondelet, Virginia, hosted a grand military ball in 1862. And one soldier wrote, "We were tendered an invitation to a military ball to come off at Estelle Springs tonight. We return our thanks to Captain Spiff for the invitation extended. We, the local, will try to be there and participate in the oft-repeated merry mazes of the dance. Like any other genial spirit, we are partial to the nip-up-to-doodle, as much as any worshiper at the shrine of fun, frolic, and foibles. We'd like to dance all night till broad daylight and go home with the gals in the morning." For some, the war precipitated a frenetic do-or-die approach. Knowing full well the risks of battle, some soldiers flaunted their gay existence. One 20th century observer caustically remarked that the reason the Confederates lost Gettysburg was that Jeb Stuart was out dancing and carousing. General Stuart was not alone in dancing to distraction, if indeed dance was the reason for his belated arrival in Pennsylvania. Other soldiers wrote of penchant for dancing and flirting. Edgar Richardson wrote home in 1861 that he had attended a party. 2 years later, his brother Robert wrote, "Brother Edgar is here as well as ever and has been as busy flying around the girls in the country here that I suppose he's not got time to write home. He's nearly all the time out with them." Bud Jones, a lieutenant in Young's brigade, Cobb Legion Cavalry, wrote several letters home describing the dances he'd attended. In one, he refrains from adding more detail about the dances due to his being teased. But he does say, "His being crazy on the subject of women, I will refrain." In another letter, Jones acknowledges his mortality when he states, "It is thought the young ladies of Fredericksburg will soon invite us to a dance, and I hope I will not be so unfortunate as to fall then. 10 weeks later, after alternating fighting and dancing, Jones was mortally wounded during the Battle of Trevilian Station. These men did not dance just for fun. Their dance was a form of therapy. It provided relief from boredom and fear, offered them hope, provided funds for food and shelter, and gave the Southerners a way to control their lives by continuing their culture. During winter months, when very little campaigning occurred, soldiers went to the nearest town for a dance with the ladies there. Dances were held in army hospitals for the ambulatory wounded, healthy soldiers, and hospital workers. Fanny Beers, a nurse in the hospital at Noonan, Georgia, noted, "These amusements were greatly encouraged by physicians and others as safety valves to relieve the high pressure of excitement, uncertainty, and dread, which were characteristic of the time. At times, unable to enjoy the company of women and desperate for diversion, the men danced with the men. When camped far from town or snowed in, soldiers danced in the tents, and those deserters, remember, imprisoned for months, danced to relieve boredom. For other more fortunate soldiers, the pleasures of home offered solace. One soldier refused another's offer of a horse, bridle, and saddle in exchange for his 30-day pass on the grounds that he wouldn't give his privilege of dancing for no horse in the army. The girls at home often gave parties and dances in honor of the soldiers home on leave. If the soldiers' hearts were lightened by dancing, so too were those who stayed home or ran before the advancing armies, seeking refuge with friends and family. By 1864, with the end near and Sherman on the march, deprivation and worry might have kept some from enjoying themselves. Yet others continued to dance in the face of disaster. Louise Wigfall, with her unique power of observation, theorized that they danced and entertained in spite of all this, or it may be because of all this trouble and sorrow, on the principle of whistling to keep one's courage up. In addition to inspiring courage, dance supported the unfortunates of war. Ladies' groups held benefit balls to aid orphans and soldiers' wives. Funds collected from the proceeds of dances helped form Soldiers' Aid Society and build homes. Charity dances helped arm and outfit military companies and honored wounded soldiers. Southern newspapers listed dozens of advertisements for the benefit balls. The Savannah Daily Morning News listed 6 in just a 2-month period. When the money ran out, spirits remained high. Ladies and gentlemen enjoyed themselves at starvation parties. Bud Jones, the gallant youth who loved to dance, described the logistics of the parties. The dances heretofore have been entirely without any expense to either party. Invitations are generally given by the young lady of the house for her willingness to have a dance at her house. And at the appointed time, the young men go after the young ladies and begin the dance at 6 or 7 o'clock. Our dances will continue probably until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And the young lady of the house is never expected to offer any refreshments of any kind, and consequently, they are no expense. After the dance is over, every gentleman takes his lady love and escorts her home, and thus they will end with an understanding where the next dance will be. So gentlemen and lady loves, the notions of chivalry and courtship, both basic premises of the Southern culture, are apparent in Jones' simple description. The culture ingrained in the people remained viable, even though, perhaps because, the war threatened to destroy all. Yet the contradiction between the turmoil of war and the pleasure derived from dance did not elude the Confederates. Several Southern newspapers commented, both positively and negatively, about a column admonishing the dancers in a time when so many young men were dying on battlefields. They asked, "Is this a time to dance?" And I quote, "When a cruel foe is threatening the principal city in our sister state and thousands of people are ordered to fly from their homes and old and young women and little children are looking for refuge from the fury of the invader, is this a time to dance? When nearly 40,000 of our brave soldiers are languishing in northern bastilles, suffering untold miseries from cold and hunger and disease, is this a time to dance? When innumerable widows and orphans all over our land are mourning for their dead, is this a time to dance? When the next mail or telegram may announce the fall of some brother, son, or husband, or friend, is this a time to dance? For one, I will not, cannot dance. Can you?" That was from the Abingdon, Virginia paper, 1864. And then a rebuttal in the same paper. "We've received from one whose connection with the author entitles him to speak authoritatively the following lines," and it's a poem. by Miss Sanford. She had written some lines about Is It Time to Dance, which were extensively copied. They were criticized in the Chattanooga Rebel as savoring of a puritanical piety, and the opinion advanced that this is the time to dance. Miss Sanford lives in Marshall, Harrison County, Texas, and is the sister of the late Lieutenant Thomas Preston Sanford, who was killed at Sharpsburg. Louisa Minor of Pantops, who had attended several dance parties early in the war, wrote in January of 1864 that she had an invite to a real dancing party at Rugby, not a starvation party. I do not go. The present seems no time for such gaiety, and those who engage in frivolity invite God's censure due to his frown. Louisa managed to overcome her guilt, however, and consternation by the end of that year, as she wrote of another Christmas party, had the tailors up one evening and we got us a dance in which Mammy Eliza and Daddy Joan, and those were her adoptive parents, Eliza Merriweather Lewis Anderson and Jefferson Randolph Anderson. Lucy Cobb of Georgia, mentioned before, also found a way around her guilty feelings, offering a description of a costume ball. You may wonder how such parties as these I have been tiring you with can find tolerance in these troubled times. I should wonder myself, it had been a studied affair. But indeed, it was merely a pleasant way to spend an evening. And the need to dance in some instances could overcome staunch patriotic feelings and animosity toward the opposing army. General John Gordon wrote later, in 1896, an officer of the Union Army told me the following story, which is but a counterpart of many which came under my own observation. A lieutenant of a Delaware regiment was officer of the picket line on the banks of the Rappahannock. The pickets of the two armies were, as usual at that time, very near each other in an almost constant communication. It was in midwinter, and no movements of the armies were expected. The Confederate officer of pickets, who was on duty on the opposite bank of the narrow stream, asked the Union lieutenant if he would not come over after dark and go with him to a farmhouse near the lines, where certain Confederates had invited the country girls to a dance. The Union officer hesitated, yet eventually accepted the invite. The Union soldier was dressed in civilian clothes, which were ill-fit, and passed off as a raw recruit. He enjoyed the dance. As dance permeated the Southern sensibilities, it became a metaphor for the war. On May 22nd of 1861, the Central Georgia and the Sandersville newspaper printed a special dispatch saying the ball had opened at Norfolk. The war is thus fairly open. Benjamin Mell, a soldier, used the same allusion in a letter to his father after the Battle of Fair Oaks, Seven Pines, in June 1862. He refers to his participation in the fight as having received an invitation to the ball. But it wasn't just fighting that caused the metaphor use. Dance permeated the culture, and deprivation can also be represented by dance. As Mary Ann Cobb of Macon wrote to her husband, General Howell Cobb, in 1864, between feasts at the Cobb Larder, the rats hold balls on the back stoop and parades in the first floor passage. And here's another really, I really love this one. A sailor's description of a dance. Now he's talking about a dance, but he's using his sailor or sea metaphor. Haven't had any fun with the landlubbers till Thursday night at a dance. When I arrived in the cabin, I found them under headway of a Spanish dance. Took my station in line with Suki Tucker, fell back and filled, then shot ahead 2 fathoms. Hauled up to starboard tack to let another craft pass, and then came astern on another sail. Spoke her, and then bore round against the sun, and fell in with another sail in full charge. Passed 20 sail on the same course, and went halfway across the other shore, dropped astern, fell back, couldn't fill, so let go anchor and hauled up for repairs. And I think he's talking about a line dance now. Mary Chestnut wrote in 1862, if it were not for this horrid war, how nice it would be, but this horrid war poisons everything. Although in many cases dance overcame the obstacles of war, there were other reasons not to dance. The moralists denigrated dance, citing not only the spiritual pitfalls inherent with dancing, but also the prospects of ill health. You can go ahead. If one got too close to one's partner, illicit thoughts might overwhelm the couple, causing them to stray from strict propriety. Or the nature of the dance's physical activity could have severe consequences to the body. One might catch a chill, become overheated, or experience vertigo. Such notions influenced many would-be dancers before the war and during it. But religion and health aside, several other situations prohibited dancing. The virtual cessation of dance as a school-related activity was a result of the war. With the advent of war and the subsequent enlistment of the male students in the Confederate Army, most schools were forced to close. Along with the closure of the schools, for the most part, commencement balls were temporarily suspended. However, the University of North Carolina did announce a commencement ball in June of 1862. An obvious consequence of the upheaval was mourning, a state many endured during the war. Rules of ethics decreed that one should not be seen in public, especially at entertainments. Scarlett's faux pas when she danced with Rhett so soon after her husband's death produced an accurate outrage by the characters in Mitchell's novel. Not only public outrage stopped the dance, personal sorrow played a major role. In 1863, Habersham noted in her diary that she was thankful to have the spirits for dancing and was not as many households were shrouded in gloom. By the end of the war, though, she had lost three sons to Union bullets, and one cannot state with conviction that the Habersham girls stopped dancing. You can only speculate that even if the girls continued indulging in the popular amusement, Mrs. Habersham's dancing days were over. The evacuation from their homes often stopped Southerners from dancing. As refugees, many discovered a life of crowded conditions or boredom. One woman who fled to Ashland, Virginia from Arlington bemoaned the suffering due to overcrowding and angrily mentioned that although the billiard rooms in the hotel were taken, the ballroom remained unoccupied. "It seems to me," she said, "it might be partitioned off to accommodate several families." Although this woman obviously had no desire to dance, others' interest in the amusement kept the ballroom open. Soldiers away from home and family could not always dance. A humorous comment in one letter mentions regional antagonism as a prevention of pleasure. He said, "I would like to come home and have a party. I think that I can enjoy it the best in the world, for we never see no women but South Carolinians, and they hate Georgians worse than I hate Yankees." For some, a sense of duty prevented them from taking part in the dance. Mary Boutrell Watson of Jackson, Georgia, recalled six friends who gave up playing games, reading, having parties, and dancing in the summer when the dark cloud of war burst over our beloved and beautiful Southland in 1861. Fanny Beers echoed Watson's friend's sentiments. As a nurse in an army hospital, she was often invited to parties and dances, but rarely accepted. The merriment seemed to her like unfaithfulness to the memory of the gallant dead and a mockery of the suffering. Beers carried the conviction with her even after the war at a Confederate Union reunion held on August 6, 1885. She refused to participate in the evening's festivities on the grounds that all day I had walked hand in hand with memory, turning again and again to clasp her closely and to feel the throbbing of her sad heart with my own. The dear presence still enthralled me, and I could imagine no countercharm in the laughing face and airy form of Terpsichore. Beers' objections to dance did not reflect the opinions of all in the white elite Southerners. Many tried to dance, but were prevented from doing so by the proximity of fighting. Mary Chestnut, in 1863, related a tale of the war's impingement on gaiety. General Hood had invited several ladies to a party and a dance at his headquarters, yet as the ladies prepared to leave Richmond for the camp, a soldier raced up on his horse and shouted, "Stop! It's all up! We're ordered back to the Rappahannock. The brigade is marching through Richmond now." The ladies, expressing slight annoyance, sighed resignedly. In Jasper County, Georgia, several people fled a barbecue when threatened with Yankee invasion. However, others ignored the risk and attended. The festivities proceeded without trouble on that day, but 1 week later, the Union soldiers arrived, and consternation filled every heart as the advance guard went riding in full speed through the village. The same consternation was felt in Atlanta and Milledgeville when Sherman occupied the Georgian cities. So in some cases, war did poison dance. When the South became embroiled in the Civil War, the white Southern elite attempted to retain the characteristics of their antebellum culture. During the final years of the war and the Reconstruction era, visible deterioration of the society occurred. With the slave system demolished and the economic base of the South shattered, the white Southerners lost control over a major portion of their lives. Nonetheless, self-discipline could be maintained and public behavior could still offer a source of pride as well as class distinction. Consistency and changes in behavior, as seen through dance, reflect the elite's effort to rise above or tolerate the Civil War. Committed to dance and entertainment, Southerners continued to host parties. When food was scarce, those starvation parties sufficed. In fact, the starvation party became a symbol of Southern pride. With children returning to school, commencement exercises resumed, and once again, dance took its place as a valuable part of the graduation. The cost of public balls went down from an average of $10 a ticket, which were probably Confederate money, during the war, to $1 or $2 per person. Newspapers listed fewer public balls, yet increased the number of advertisements for a dance education. Carpetbaggers invaded the domain of the dance master, and eventually the quality of dance decreased. Before the war, most masters were capable theatrical dancers who performed as well as taught. Eager for an easy dollar, dancers of modest skill began to teach and exploited the poor Southerners who happened to impress society, who hoped to impress society with their dancing skills. The students, limited by the teacher's scant knowledge, were not able to perform the intricate steps known before the war, and eventually the fancy quadrille became a dance through which the partners walked, and someone called. In addition, dancers were starting their training later. Without the benefit of an early dance education, the adult dancers not only found the steps difficult, but also could not be expected to know the various figures by rote. The physical nature of dance prevented some white Southerners from dancing. Men who lost limbs or became otherwise infirm could no longer undertake the rigors of the dance floor. Young ladies started declining dances on the grounds of exhaustion. Unused to manual labor, the girls complained that housework tired them. Eliza Andrews called her group of friends the Broomstick Brigade. But not all dancing stopped. The youngsters still mentioned it as a favorite diversion. Even Eliza continued to dance at night, tired as she was. She still complained about her feet and about the dance styles. For some, the old-fashioned quadrilles retained their popularity, and the waltz continued to hold sway over other round dances. In 1866, the Southern elite still snubbed the polka, yet within a decade, that silly dance, with several comical variations, found its way into the Southern ballroom. The ideals of chivalry and gentility stayed firmly implanted in Southerners. Instead of military parades and balls, the Southerners turned to tournaments and royal balls, amusements long enjoyed in the South. Murta Avery records one such tournament in her book, Dixie After the War. Knights riding valiant steeds competed for rings in a game of skill. Several of the knights wore their gray uniforms as if the war had never ended. After the contest was won, the victor would choose his queen of love and beauty from the damsels gathered for the day. The evening festivities naturally included a ball at which a fiddler played. And the Daily Chronicle in Charlottesville in August of 1865 announced, "There is to be a grand tournament today a few miles beyond Earlysville. It will be followed by a picnic and a ball. Oh, how many palpitating hearts there are in Earlysville as the thought occurs, shall I be the queen of love and beauty?" Although much stayed the same, in some ways the gay life was over. Yet when the soldiers straggled home after the war, they were greeted by women who felt it the part of love and patriotism to give them good cheer. Opening their homes as well as their hearts, amusements were planned, which often included dancing after dinner. But at times, the lack of footwear prevented the men from dancing, and some were so destitute they refused to enter the house, preferring instead to stay in the barn. In the occupied South, the dance continued, but the participants changed. Confederates seethed with hatred for the Yankee invader and his cohort, who often escorted black women to the balls. Dozens of scathing articles were written by journalists announcing these Negro balls, at which these women were feted and toasted and monopolized the entire crew of Yankees and some of the sympathizers who have affiliated. Journalists were not the only Southerners writing of their disgust. The Yankee participants upset everyone. All of Georgia seemed to take offense at a ball hosted by General Sherman and his staff at the Trout House in Atlanta. That's the Trout House. The strength of the rage felt by the elitist Southerners was unsurpassed. One officer wrote to a sister about a ball while on picket near Brucetown, Virginia. He said, "Oh shame, where is thy blush?" Although limited by uncontrollable social change, curfew laws and subjugation, and loss of the economic base on which their society rested, Confederates held dear the myth of a unique Southern culture. The Union Army may have conquered the Southerner on the battlefield, but it did not crush the Southern spirit, within which resided the love of dance. As Eliza Andrews noted in her reminiscences, "It may seem strange to the modern reader that in the midst of such tremendous happenings, we could find it in our hearts to go about the common business of life, to laugh and dance and be merry in spite of the crumbling of the social fabric about us. But so it has always been, so it was in the days of Noah, and so we are told will it be in the end of the world. Youth will have its innings, and never was social life in the Old South more full of charm, than when tottering to its fall. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.